So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Ollie Mann. This is The Modern Man. We are the monthly magazine show for your ears. And here's what's coming up today.
I decided that the shareholders should help keep me accountable. So I put up a vote asking the shareholders if they wanted control over my romantic life.
What happens when you delegate life choices to your financial supporters? I meet the man who sells shares in himself. Plus,
for a start, he might want to look into dry orgasms.
Alex Fox on student sex in a textbook foxhole, and Ollie Peart immerses me in art. That's all to come in this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters and a warning about ChatGPT. Following last month's correspondence from Josh in Devon, you might remember him, inspired by our conversation in The Zeitgeist, writing in to say he was considering using generative AI to make computer code for his air ambulance charity. Don't do it, says this email from fellow man fan Jamie Taylor. He says, "Hi Ollie, I'm a software developer, and in my view, just as a journalist shouldn't submit an AI-generated article to their editor without reading through it first, man fans should not use AI tools as their only step in generating code. There is nothing to stop these apps from writing malicious code, overloading your computer hardware, working around security mechanisms, wiping your data, or worse. Or code which does things like mining Bitcoin in the background. In fact, in many of my tests, ChatGPT has generated buggy code that doesn't even solve the problem you give it, and in more than a few cases won't even run. It's also worth noting that ChatGPT doesn't write code, rather it uses code which is already available online, sometimes ignoring licensing rules, and attempts to shoehorn this in as a solution to your problem. This is like taking the engine from a Ford Cortina and trying to use it to power a Tesla." Thank you, Jamie, for ending your email there with a metaphor I can understand. Obviously, you know, you need to justify why experts like you will still have a role in the marketplace. And I guess that bit of it, consulting professionals at the end of the process, is the bit that seems most valid to me. Like, you might use AI to help you at the beginning, as you're suggesting. Like, you know, legally, you might get ChatGPT to write a contract, but then ask a lawyer to look it over. And I guess theoretically, that's, you know, half an hour of a lawyer's time, isn't it, rather than 3 hours. I can see things going that way. But yes, thank you for the sobering reminder that computers cannot be trusted to do everything themselves. Yet. Hello as well to Peter in Derby, who says, "Ollie, I'm a long-time Man fan and Beer Money donor. Thanks so much for such a great podcast." You're welcome, Peter. "I really look forward to what you've got in store each month. Your mix of light-hearted entertainment and content that hits right in the feels is fantastic, particularly for me, your How to Be a Dad episodes, because I've got 2 kids, age 4 and 7, and just being able to relate to other people in the same boat as me has really been a comforting experience. Please pass my thanks and praise to all the team." No need, Peter. I've now modestly read out your email, so now everyone knows how much you love us. And you're right, we are excellent. He continues, "I've been meaning to up my beer money donations for a while, but a recent card cloning scam forced me to do some long overdue life admin." So here we are. And indeed, he has upped his donation to £5 a month. So thank you, Peter. Something good came from something bad there. He says, "If the Manbassador position for Derby is still vacant, I hereby humbly apply for the role and promise to conduct myself in a manner befitting such a revered title." It is, Peter. Although, actually, if only you'd asked, I mean, I've got the spreadsheet open here. I think you probably could have been ambassador for all of Derbyshire. I'm not seeing an ambassador for Chesterfield. I'm not seeing an ambassador for Woodville. I'm not seeing an ambassador for Glossop. But anyway, yes, Derby's yours. Why not? I now pronounce you ambassador for Derby. Congratulations. And thank you to everybody who, like Peter, has been digging in their pockets this month to support us financially, especially if they were already supporting us. You guys really are helping us make this show right now. You are making it possible. I mean, as you can hear, I'm not reading a sponsored message right now. So thank you to our new monthly donors, Colin Chisholm, Anna Schindler, Matt Pavey, and Bob Leader. You truly are a leader, Bob. Welcome on board. And one-off donors, man fans Catherine and Ashley in Victoria, Australia, a Mr. G. Maguire of East Lothian. PayPal sometimes just gives me initials. I'm sure you hadn't intended your shout-out to be quite so formal. And a big special sloppy thanks to Michael in Chelmsford, who's given a very generous one-off donation. Thanks, Michael. Look, whatever you can afford, buy us a beer, drop us a line, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and support our independent podcast. Right, coming up on today's show, you will learn what the University of Kansas says 1/4 of men have done in the bedroom. You'll learn what attracted 2.5 million visitors in Osaka, and you'll learn what a verified trusted authenticity certificate is in the context of a tattoo. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested, with a man who's wearing what appears to be an all-in-one shell suit. It's Ollie Peart.
Well, it's all part of today, this is.
But I have been summoned by you to... we're at a place called the Blue Elephant Theatre, which is a fringe theatre in Camberwell. I know we're here because Maxine and Dalston tasked you with investigating the trend for immersive art experiences. And this is, I'm guessing, where you've set up an immersive art experience for me, for an audience of one.
Downstairs, I got a theatre, but upstairs, they've got a gallery. And we've managed to sneak in between two exhibitions to put on our Modern Man-themed interactive immersive art exhibition.
There's like a weird rumbling drone sound coming through those doors.
It's like when you go to a cinema and you can hear the rumblings of the trailers, and you're kind of like, ooh, what am I going to see? What's going to be in there? You can't work out what that is, can you?
It is a bit like that. I suppose the difference is when you go in a cinema, you've had the experience before, haven't you? Whereas this is the absence of control, which is what's making me anxious. So tell me a bit about immersive art then, because we said last episode that I've sort of heard of like the Dali exhibit and things, but I've never been to one.
An interactive immersive art experience will combine technology, storytelling, interactive art pieces, a bit like the Science Museum. Do you remember going to the Science Museum as a kid? That was amazing. You could play and you could touch things and sort of interact with it. And that's the idea. It's sort of putting you in the art so you can sort of learn more about it.
Very dangerous precedent to set for children, I think, that, because...
You know, touching art.
Yeah. Then they go to the National Portrait Gallery, don't they? They think they can just press everything.
You know, for kids especially, it is... I know this through anecdotally. My brother was actually my trove of facts for all of this stuff because he's been to loads, because he takes his kids there. Because it is the kind of place where you can just go along with kids, while away a few hours. They have a great time and they might learn something about some of the artists that are on exhibit as well, like Van Gogh and Dali that we've spoken about before.
But I imagine some people, some art purists, would probably think that it's like real lowest common denominator stuff, right? Like you should be able to sit and contemplate a great painting from 300 years ago and not have it projected on a wall at 20 foot height in front of you and pretend you're walking into it, because that's not how it's designed to be seen.
There are some of these interactive experiences that people are like, it's not really art. This is just more for, you know, Instagrammers to get that shot. You know, it's not really about the artist or anything like that. It is just like, we're going to create this incredible sort of visual space and then you can snap your selfies in it and share it on TikTok and that kind of stuff. And there is a debate about that. But some of them are both, like, they're incredible pieces of art in their own right, but they're also like incredibly interactive and you can learn a huge amount. So one of the ones my brother pointed me to was a Danish guy, and he's got an exhibition in Denmark, in Copenhagen. His name's Olafur Eliasson. He created an entire riverbed in an art gallery. So it genuinely looks like a riverbed. So it's got like this stream running through and a load of rocks, and essentially that's all it is. You know, it's a load of gravel and rocks and mud and stuff just sort of shoved in this big white space, big white room. But it's way more than that. It's sort of, it's a story about how riverbeds are changing, and it's you can sort of bend down and interact with the water and the stones and stuff, but you're in this weird sort of sterile environment.
I suppose as well, there's the argument, isn't there? Like, you know, if Turner was alive today, he wouldn't just be a painter. You know, people say that about Shakespeare, don't they? Or if Shakespeare was alive today, he'd be writing for EastEnders. He wouldn't be writing for the RSC.
He'd be using ChatGPT.
Exactly.
That's what he'd be doing.
Well, no, he'd be using Bard, surely. But anyway, the point is, the technology that's available to you now is putting people into the middle of stuff, right? So, okay, we're going to go into this rumbly noise art space. I know that your budget has been £50. Am I going to see anything that I'll want to pose for a selfie in front of for my gram?
Yeah, I'm going to say yeah.
Right, well, I'm interested. Let's do this.
Okay, first though, we need to discuss the entry fee. Because you can't just turn up to these things. They're not free. So your entry fee is your British Podcast Award.
Okay, yes. I was wondering why producer Matt had asked me to traipse across town with a Perspex trophy in my bag. Okay, so...
Only people that have won British Podcast Awards can access this exhibition.
Here
it is. It's been well looked after.
I've passed you the, 2018 award for best interview.
Doesn't even know his own award. It's the 2019 best interview award.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, I don't think we've got any fear that this is going to get nominated next year. Let's have a look inside.
Okay, you ready? Here we go.
Oh! I am walking into a space that has some paper hanging from the ceiling in the shape of different... It's our logo, isn't it? It's our deconstructed logo.
It's a deconstructed logo, Ollie.
Yes, I see. I did. It took me a minute. I was like, why am I walking into a big blue circle? But that's my face on the logo, isn't it? I could put this behind me and that could be just like the cover art.
Exactly.
You're
that.
Right.
Look, you're already interacting
I'm
with
already
it.
Thinking, how would people perceive this on social media? And that's the same thing as living, isn't it? Okay, I'm going to walk in underneath the logo. And
a groundbreaking immersive experience that thrusts you headfirst into the sometimes bizarre world of the Modern Man podcast.
Is this someone imitating
I'm
me?
Ollie Mann,
oh my god.
Or at least a rather impressive AI facsimile.
Oh, fuck you.
You might be astonished to discover that everything I'm saying has been concocted by ChatGPT, an incredibly advanced AI language model.
I can hear it's
like
not me.
Genius on tap as discussed in episode 14.
Episode, I don't
Challenge
say that.
Ian. And as for this lovely voice you're hearing, it's also an AI creation. That's right, no rest for the wicked. This delightful bit of tech trickery was inspired by episode 11 over 1, The Mum Who Gave Up Drinking, where the ever-curious Ollie Peart explores the world of deepfakes. Amazing,
wow,
right?
It is amazing.
Now brace yourselves, dear visitors, as you're about to be treated to a smorgasbord of moments from Zeitgeist Recordings, lovingly curated by none other than Ollie Peart himself. Yes, it's true. Our very own Ollie has managed to extract what he thinks are the podcast's most memorable bits. Bless him. As you amp-
Oh, it was sarcastic. Did it know to be sarcastic?
You whisk away on a roller coaster ride of emotions, laughter, and face palms. All courtesy.
I wouldn't write something this flowery.
Clueless curator.
Now here, Ollie, is our sensory light display.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is inspired by a company called Team Labs, who create these immersive experiences all over the world. New York, Osaka, Singapore. And they do it in huge rooms with flowers and water. And
what I'm looking at is a plinth with a cloth draped on it that looks a bit like someone's tried to decorate Chessington World of Adventures and make it look spooky. That's basically it. Someone's just like made it black and scary looking, but otherwise... It's hard to see it in the context you just gave.
Yeah, sure.
As yet.
Right, but we couldn't do a whole room.
No.
Because we have a £50 budget.
Yes, yeah.
So what we've done instead is created this small headspace.
Uh-huh.
So what you got to do is pop your head just in there.
I put my head under the cloth.
Yeah, and enjoy the experience.
My head is on top of a light source that is projecting purple and blue images into my eyes. And there's a giant picture of my face in front of me. And what does this represent? Am I in the foxhole? Is that the idea? What is it supposed to be? Is it just an artsy representation of a kind of... It's a bit carnivalesque.
No, it's just... All it is you know, it was just inspiration from the flower room that the Team Labs guys did. I tried to create a flowery scape that you might, you know, want to snap a selfie in with yourself.
I see, yes. I feel a bit exposed because my bottom is just hanging out the back of this plinth and I can't see, and I've not been in this room before and I don't know who else is in here. So if we're done, yeah. I'd quite like to, yes, can I reverse out?
You can come out, yeah. Okay.
Well, it definitely took me to a different place.
All right. Next, there's a projection on the wall with lots of avatars of me.
Yep.
Actually me, not a representation of me, but a photo of me in a suit looking forthright. But there's like five of them juggling around.
Well, there's also some music to go with this.
Right.
So it's not just that, it's also an audio experience as well.
Is it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Captain Spronker.
Oh, it's Captain Sprong. It's a remix, though, is it?
It's a brand new Captain Sprong.
Wow. Now I feel truly privileged. Now I get it, yes.
Look, we're part of it, look.
Yes, yeah. So I think possibly by accident rather than design, our silhouettes are now dancing over the image that we're looking at because you placed the projector a little too low in the room, but it does have an effect of immersing us in the art. So that's quite good, yeah.
By accident, this is all planned. Sure. Can you not tell?
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
dancing.
I am. Yeah, yeah. It's just. I mean, it's a bit like that episode of Alan Partridge where he goes to that bloke's house, and there's like hundreds of representations of him. That's what this is like, which is really weird.
Not anything original. Just a packet of crisps and a biscuit. A biscuit. Dismiss this biscuit. Never go lift. Makes sense, doesn't matter. This is Captain Spronk original. Captain Spronk original. Captain Spronk original. Captain Spronk original. Captain Spronk.
If you'd like to make your way over this way, Ollie, you can see another one of my interactive displays.
Yeah, this looks like this is set up for like a magic trick. Mm. So there's like a teacup that looks like it's got tea in it that's under a plastic dome. Oh, is it the tea you made?
It's a mix of two episodes. So one of the episodes is the one where I wasn't in it because I was having a baby, and Alex explored the trend for scents.
Yes.
And also the mix of carroty within that. So this is a smell right. experience. So the cloche on top, what you've got to do is remove it.
Cloche, yeah. I said plastic dome, I think. I couldn't reach for cloche.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a plastic party bowl from the range, but yeah.
Don't... That's interesting how you've achieved it. I was just impressed by the vocabulary. But I'm getting something out of the exhibit. You know, there's layers, right?
Yeah.
Like plosh, yeah. You've
of course there is.
Stimulated something in my brain, haven't you? You've triggered off a neuron.
I'm so hot.
Yeah. Why are you wearing the shell suit onesie? It's still not clear.
The shell suit onesie is because in the episode where we did the outdoor barbecues, we had to do it remotely because it was during COVID.
Yes. Right? So I never got to see that outfit.
You never got to see it, but on the video call, I was wearing this outside because I thought it would be funny, but you couldn't really see me because it was all pixelated, so I thought I'd wear it in person.
I mean, I certainly appreciate you putting in that physical endurance.
Well, thank you. Right, unleash the cloche and have a sniff.
Looking forward to getting my fingers right under the cloche. I mean, it's amazing how many times we've done episodes where I have to smell things and my descriptive powers have never got any better. I keep getting put in this situation where I'm supposed to say something. I mean, it smells a bit like shampoo. Doesn't smell like carrot particularly. It's a bit like a bulldog shower gel, you know, like bergamot and lemon or something.
Yeah. Well, what it actually is tea inspired by the carrot tea.
With a carrot dipped in it.
No, with hand sanitizer.
Oh, okay.
So it's a hand sanitizer smell that's been diluted down to create this scent.
With what you're wearing, it's COVID. Conjuring up COVID.
It's amazing that you think it does smell like shampoo because it just makes me think that maybe they do just use hand sanitizer and tea.
It's probably not that far off, is it? Like tea gets into a lot of chemical products and frankly, so does the glycerin and soap that's in hand sanitizer. I mean, it's a discussion for another day. Anyway, that smelt like a thing, yes.
Put the cloche back on for the next visitor.
Uh-huh.
Oh, over here. So one of the things that these experiences do, as I said before, is they combine technology within their sort of... the exhibition. And
is this,
here...
Is this your Oculus headset?
Yes.
Is this the famous Ollie Pitt Oculus headset?
This is it.
Wow. It was worth the admission price of an award.
Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you into the virtual space that we created.
Ah. Okay. Yes. I'm back in our space. I remember this place.
Is different experience being in it. It's much better. Okay. Now I can hear a hacksaw. This is really weird. Why have you put me in a gallery space and then made the sound of a hacksaw next to me? You're chopping up my award.
Yeah, this is part of the art.
Right.
This is, we're going to deconstruct your award with a hacksaw. Gosh, it's quite a strong award, actually.
I mean, I do think this is an artistic representation of what you do to the show.
We were originally going to do it beforehand.
Yeah.
And then have it in like a, you know, hanging in various parts so you could see your award kind of displayed in an interactive way. We ran out of time, so I thought I'd just do it as a sort of performative piece.
Right, okay.
So it's a bit of a sort of interpretation. You wouldn't normally get this in an interactive art space.
No, no, you wouldn't. I'm a bit worried you're going to like saw into your leg.
Don't worry about that. It'll be fine. There we go. I think that's part of it. That's lovely. That's now an art piece we've created there.
Okay. So is that the is that the finale to the?
Yeah, that was the end of the big exhibition.
I'm just trying to understand whether this is better than if I read a magazine article about the show or just listened to the show. As, you know, helping my understanding of the show, which is kind of what, you know, interactive art's about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what we've established here is that on £50, trying to create an interactive art experience is very, very difficult to do it well.
Yeah.
You know, the amounts of money that are spent on these exhibitions runs into the millions. It's a huge amount of money. So for us to be able to do it in this small gallery space, the way that we have, well, I'd say it's a triumph, but... it's still not very good.
Well, no, I'd say you've achieved what you set out to achieve. And there's a full stop on that sentence. Okay, so that experience has now come to an end. Sadly, there is no gift shop.
Mm.
But we've reconvened in the theatre bar, got a cup of coffee. Mm. I mean, what do you make of it, Ollie? Do you now feel that there is room for this trend to grow into a genuine phenomenon, or do you think it's just a flash in the pan?
I think what you'll see is a hybrid, basically. So if you go and see an exhibition of, say, Van Gogh or, I don't know, another insert famous artist here, then there'll be an interactive element to that exhibition. So it'll be less about just going to see that one specific piece of Picasso art.
Yeah.
It'll be that, and there'll be a room with all this interactive experience to get the kids excited.
But as a base level, so like people will expect, like you'd expect there now, to be a little sign next to each painting telling you when it was painted, and you'd expect there to be like a braille version of it. You think that you just expect an interactive component in every exhibit?
I think for higher profile artists, yeah. I think there will be that expectation, and I think galleries will be looking at it because the popularity of them is, you know, it can't be ignored. I mean, we spoke about it before about how many videos you see online on like Instagram Reels or whatever and TikTok of people at these exhibitions. They're clearly really popular. Team Labs, who were one of the companies I mentioned when I was taking you around, their Osaka exhibition in 1 year, in its first year, had 2.5 million visitors. Doing this, though, what it has made me realise is just how difficult it is to create something that is immersive, looks slick and good.
You did well, considering the budget and time limitations that you had.
Oh, I didn't even show you that one.
What is that?
That's the Bright Lights of New York.
Okay, to represent our trip to New York.
Represent our trip to New York.
Okay, I mean, I can see why you'd forget about three glossy pieces of paper stapled to the wall, but again, that's another component.
That's my point.
Yeah.
You know, like that would be, if that was done in one of these proper exhibitions, that would be an entire room with laser displays and projected artworks and you know, all that kind of stuff. And like flashing lights, they'd probably have half a taxi in there that you could get into.
Mm.
You know?
Mm, I do know, yes.
I didn't have the budget for half a taxi.
No, I'm convinced by your baseline argument.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, I think I articulated the thing you were hinting at, but I'm convincing myself that that is going to be the way exhibits are. Yeah, I can see that. All right, should we do your trend for next month then?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's from Justin in Eastbourne, who says, with a month to go, I'm already sick and tired of hearing about the coronation everywhere. I can't believe I'm the only one, so I would like Ollie to explore whether republicanism is a growing trend.
Growing trend. That's interesting. Mm. I doubt it in the lead up to a coronation. People getting a free bank holiday.
Well, this is it, isn't it? I mean, is that the soft power way
that the monarchy operates these days.
Free holidays.
Just make people feel good about it and then they won't question how it all works.
Well, how many days off did we get over the Jubilee? That was amazing. I was like, I don't care who's the Queen. These extra days are amazing.
But I suppose if you're a like diehard Republican, and we've never talked about this before, I mean, you've got a beard, but I'm going to still say that probably neither of us are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans. But if you were...
Yeah.
This would be the moment, wouldn't it? This would, like, changing of the guard, new king. This would be the moment to say, okay, you know, we had respect for the old lady, but she's gone now. Now it's time to have republic. Is that happening or not?
Yeah, I'd argue it's the worst time.
Okay.
Well, because nobody's going to listen to you, are they?
Well, you're going to find out. Because we want you to immerse yourself into the world of republicanism.
Okay.
Perhaps attend a rally whilst everyone else is having a picnic.
Do you reckon they've got scones and sandwiches?
Definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and probably some good craft beer.
Am I allowed to eat coronation chicken for the duration of this challenge?
Yeah, well, that was in tribute to the previous coronation, so if anything, that's a subversive thing to do.
Yeah, but if you're a Republican, you cannot eat coronation chicken, surely.
I mean, to be honest, I think eating coronation chicken is a subversive thing to do at any time of the year.
Right, okay.
Thank you, Ollie. If you've got a trend that you would like to set to Mr. Pitt to explore on a future edition of the show, head to modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and click on the feedback form. In a moment, more art of a different kind. You will meet Mike. But next, it's our record of the month. It's this from Eliza Rose. It's called Better Love, and it's out now.
I was in for a penny, out for a pound. I was wearing a crown whenever you came around. I was blinded by glitter, shackled by gold, 'cause you had so many secrets that were never to be told. One day I found out about you, oh, the curtains were cleared. It was worse than I hoped for, it was worse than I feared. No, I wasn't your diamond, I was no precious thing. I was just another pearl on your endless string. You need to be much better.
Now, if you're a listener to comedy podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, then you may have heard a few weeks back on there the team discussing delegating decisions. And in particular, the story of one man from Alaska who turned himself into a publicly traded company. It is an eye-catching story because it's unclear at first glance whether it's an art project or a money-making exercise. And actually, what we thought was even more intriguing than that is that the man concerned, Mike Merrill, who now lives in LA, he's still at it. He's still selling shares in himself. He puts his important life decisions to his shareholders, and he's 14 years in to doing this. So this clearly isn't just a satirical stunt. And we had questions for Mike about what his life is like, about what decisions he's delegated away, and how, where, and when this whole scheme came into being.
It's Portland, Oregon, and it's the late 90s, early 2000s. There's a real like anti-capitalist vibe in, you know, young subculture that's going on there, especially the DIY music scene. It's very, everything's very suspicious. The bigger something is, the more suspicious it is. Like Starbucks is coming in and people are protesting. Like, you know, there's a guy that keeps climbing up on top of City Hall to, you know, yell about some logging operation in the Oregon forest. And so there's a lot of this kind of like online kind of digital anti-corporate activism. And I think for me, that's where it started, was a little bit of this subversive element of, oh, you can kind of play with some of this stuff. I was working at this giant shipping company that had their main headquarters in Portland. They'd been a trucking company, and I think we're slowly turning into a logistics company. And I was a like front desk security guard. So like the little like maroon blazer and a clip-on tie, and I would sit at the front desk. And it was a publicly traded company, but they had the stock price every day, like on this digital sign in the lobby. Mm. And so I would watch as all these employees came in, and the first thing they did was like look up at this sign, because all of their like retirement and, you know, future was embedded in this number. Cut to some friends and I are doing this ridiculous project where a new alt-weekly newspaper had started up in Portland, Oregon. And they did this big charity auction. One of the things they listed was a date with, either all of the women on staff or all of the men. You could bid on and then go on a date with all of them. And in my mind, I was like, okay, here's an opportunity for something. I wanted to win that auction and then surprise them when they all show up on the date. It was actually going to be like an elimination style reality show. And we were just going to like put them through contests and vote them out, you know, one after another. And so I gathered up a bunch of friends to like film it. You know, we were going to pool this money, win this auction, set up all the locations for it. I was like, okay, this is going to be, I'm going to turn the tables on their little stunt and do a stunt on their stunt. But I lost the auction by like a couple bucks. I was like calling friends being like, can you put in a little more? Someone's outbidding us. Super, super disappointed. But the thing that stuck with me was like so many people I knew were willing to basically front me or promise that they would pay a bunch of money if I did this very dumb stunt.
Mm.
And I was like, well, that's interesting. What if they had all given me the money ahead of time and I just had a big pool of money and then we all voted on, you know, like what dumb thing I decided to do. Taking that kind of DIY Pacific Northwest style of like, hey, if you can record your own music on a 4-track, you know, and put out your demo tape, why can't we do the same thing with capitalism? Why can't we do DIY capitalism?
But with an end goal of profit, end goal of artistic statement, or just both?
I wasn't looking to be like, oh, I want to get rich. I wasn't really trying to say like, oh, this is going to really show the flaws of capitalism or highlight the benefits. I was just like, this is just a weird idea that I want to see in the world. What if people just bought shares in me and then together we would decide which of these projects to pursue and we just do one after another of these projects? So can I turn myself and my own kind of personal network into a little bit of a cohesive crew of collaborators to work on creative projects? That was kind of the initial idea.
Shares in you, not your company, not your project, you.
Right, exactly. That's the thing of like, how does this framework of a publicly traded company work if you apply it to an individual person? Because we all have people who are, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like invested in our future, right? Like your parents are very invested in your future. And I guess like the difference is like my parents are literally invested in my future. Well, I mean, my dad is. My dad owns shares. My mom doesn't.
Why isn't your mom a shareholder?
To be she's not wrong, but she, my mom doesn't think that you should value the input of somebody's advice based on how much money they've given you.
How did you decide on the share price? How many shares are there when you decide to make something a shareholder company, but it isn't a company? How does that even work?
So I found a friend who had just been starting to learn how to program, and I sort of sketched out this idea of a market with users and, you know, trading and all that. And he was like, I think I could build that, and it sounds interesting to build. So he was on board. So I paid him $500 in cash and gave him 500 shares.
Oh, so you set the price. Did you know that you were setting the price?
So I just kind of arbitrarily decided there's going to be 100,000 shares and I'm going to list them. I'll start with $1 a share. And my thinking was, I had a full-time job at the time. I was like, I can definitely justify that my evenings and weekends from this point until I die is worth $100,000. Like, no one can object to that valuation.
What was the first decision that you put to your shareholders?
We had just gotten the website started and not everything was working quite, you know, like there's still some bugs in it. People were still kind of like testing things out. And I think the very first thing I put was, can we start projects now? Like, okay, we're up and running. Let's start getting some votes out. And the shareholders were like, no, we're not ready yet. So they shut it down right away.
But over the years, Mike's investors have voted on a series of different decisions.
There was a, you know, any sort of online project that I'm going to try, like a new podcast or a video series, or we did like a book club, things like that are usually up for vote. I have two tattoos that are also part of a shareholder project where It's called a verified trusted authenticity certificate. And I basically, for money, will verify that I trust you and then get your name tattooed on my body. Let's see. Diet has come up a couple different times. I've been vegetarian and then not. Oh, I started a company with a friend of mine and we weren't able to pay ourselves for a while. And so I asked my shareholders if I could just take 1,000 shares and basically sell them into the market to live on for a while. So it did actually financially support me. Oh, I can't watch superhero movies. No Marvel or DC movies or television shows.
Me neither, but I mean, you know, that wasn't because of a vote.
They're garbage, but there's so many of them.
Who was the first shareholder who came on board that you had no idea who they were? Do you still know who that person was?
Yeah, it was scary. There was this guy named Gordon Shepherd who suddenly just bought like 100 shares out of nowhere, you know, and the price had been going up. So it was like, you know, somebody spent like a couple $100 buying shares. And I was like, that's weird. Who's this person? So I emailed him and I was just like, hey, thanks so much. If you have any questions or ideas or want to talk about anything, or I'd even hop on a phone call, let me know. You know, because I was like, I need to figure out who this person is. And he just writes back, no, I'm good. Thanks. Nothing. And any offer that was below $4, he just gobbled it up. So he created a new floor price where when I started, it was $1 a share. Now it was like the share price was not going to go below $4 a share. If you made an offer below that, he would just grab it no matter what. Hmm. And he kept doing it. So suddenly he has this not only just like massive amount of shares. I don't know who he is, but he now has like a really powerful impact on what I do in my life.
How did that manifest itself?
I was dating somebody and we decided to move in together and found this amazing like loft apartment space. Whatever, it was great. Moved in and my really good friend Steve said, hey, that should have been a shareholder vote. Moving in with your girlfriend. And I was like, that doesn't really seem like part of my online project. And he's like, yeah, but it's going to have a big impact on so many aspects of your life. How could it not be? But I was kind of thinking along those lines, like, okay, what other kind of personal decisions can I put up?
Why were you thinking that? I mean, I understand the logic of it from the point of view of the shareholder who's having fun with the idea. But for you, as the person doing it, who's kept your private life away from it, what appealed to you about that concept?
I think there are two things. I think the first is it was a little bit of like thumbing my nose at this idea of, oh, you want something personal? I'll show you personal. And then the other half of it is I think as a publicly traded person, I act a little bit in service of my shareholders. Like I want them to be engaged and entertained. It's very like running any kind of online community. The difference is, you know, it's about me versus whatever kind of other things. And so I thought, okay, what's something really personal I can kind of throw out there? And I think the first thing I was like, I was like, oh, should I change my hair color? Because I was like going gray and that no one cared and that got voted down. And I was like, okay, that's not it. That didn't quite resonate enough. And then at the time I was really thinking about a really personal decision that I was kind of split on. I was thinking about getting a vasectomy. I was in my mid-30s and I was pretty sure I didn't want kids. And so I suddenly realized, I was like, oh, I have a decision-making engine right here in front of me. I can just put this up for a vote.
And that was a serious intent behind that.
I really wasn't sure. I was like, you know, I was like 50-50. I was like, I could go either way. I wanted the decision to be made one way or the other felt more satisfying than just sitting with it.
But it is an invasive medical procedure that you're then putting into the hands of other people.
That's the part that is like seemingly extreme, but I think we all do this when we have a big decision. Like if you started having thoughts about getting a vasectomy, you'd probably go talk to a bunch of your friends about it. You'd probably talk to your family. You know, in my case, all those people are shareholders.
Yeah, but Gordon doesn't get a deciding vote. I mean, that's what's really weird, right?
That is the weird part. But he bought a lot of shares in me.
like, there's something about this project that is becoming a big part of my identity that he was attracted to enough to also want to experiment and play in this thing.
So you posted up, should I get a vasectomy?
46% said, yes, get one. 55% said, no, don't get one. And the deciding vote, it was Greg, who I'd given the 500 shares to. He came in with his shares and voted no and sort of tanked it in the other direction of not getting a vasectomy.
You talked about the language that you used to ask the question. I wonder if, as you started asking these more personal questions to your shareholders of yourself, you began to work out the rhythm, the cadence, the formula of how to ask a question to get the result that you wanted.
Yeah, definitely. It starts to get really political pretty early as I'm thinking about shareholder questions, because I know most of the shareholders. You know, there aren't that many Gordon Shepherds out there. And even Gordon, I'm learning about him via his comments and his history of votes and things like that. So I kind of started creating this personality or this kind of like separate persona that was, I started wearing all Brooks Brothers clothes.
Why? I mean, a lot of these people you never meet or see.
Because the idea of the shareholder starts kind of being around me all the time. Like, I'm thinking actively about the presence of the shareholders and their judgment. And I want to act in a way that I think that they would want me to act. I don't put everything up for a vote. There's a lot of decisions that are really mundane of like, you know, what do I want to eat for breakfast? Or, you know, like, I don't want to bore people with like the really easy questions. At the same time, I want to take the actions even in those small mundane things that the shareholders would approve of.
How personal did it get? I mean, if you started with the vasectomy question, where did you get to?
It got pretty personal. The relationship with the person that I'd moved in with and then put up the vasectomy vote, like that relationship ended. We dated for about 5 years. And that was my second 5-year long relationship in a row. And I thought, I must be doing something in my relationships to have them kind of follow this pattern of, you know, moving in together, really feeling like there's a future, and then something happens at this 5-year mark where things start to fall apart. Like, and so in my mind, I was like, I need to be as intentional about who I'm dating as any other aspect of my life. And so for a year, I just didn't date at all. I was just like, I moved in to this apartment on my own. I decorated it like I thought the shareholders would like. It was a very office. It was a very office environment. And after about a year, I was like, okay, I want to start dating. But again, how do I maintain this aspect of being super intentional about it and making sure I don't fall back into patterns of, you know, just being flattered by somebody else's attention and then letting that go on too long. And so, you know, I decided that the shareholder should help keep me accountable. And so I put up a vote asking the shareholders if they wanted control over my romantic life. And of course they said yes. Like, they're like, absolutely, yes, we want control over that. And I was like, okay, now how do I do this? Because it's one thing to put up votes that affect me, you know, and maybe like kind of echo into friends and family and things like that. It's another to say, hey, here's a person, judge them, you know, on my behalf. And so I didn't feel comfortable with that. So I came up with a system where every shareholder had a special code that was unique to them to log in. And I would write up a report of a date that I went on. And I would put a pseudonym and no photos. And I would just describe the date that I went on and how it went. In this case, There was basically like a thumbs up, thumbs down vote for an approval rating, but all of the votes were private. And I remember that like the first time I went on a date with someone, I wrote up, you know, what I thought was this very like, oh, this is how I would explain to anyone how this date went. And the first question was, one of the shareholders was like, did you like her? And I was like, oh, I wrote up this whole thing. But again, I think I was still in this very kind of like corporate mindset. Like, I gave no indication of if I liked her, because I was saying like, oh, let the shareholders decide this information. Do the shareholders like her? But obviously what the shareholders wanted to know was what my emotional state was. And so that, I was like, okay, fine.
And it did help you find someone that you did fall in love with.
Yeah. So I think on the romance site, she was called Agassi, because one of the first things I learned about her was that she played tennis, and she was like rising in the ranks very clearly. And then at one point we were on a date and she smoked, and I mentioned that, and then you know, her numbers went way down because people were like, oh, don't date a smoker. And I was like, oh no, I have to now like prove to them that it's, you know, that she's worthy. And eventually she bought shares, but she ended up like voting herself up and voting everyone else down. And I was like, well, what could be more romantic than some shareholder activism? And so eventually as things got more serious, I was like, well, okay, what's the next step? How do you corporatize a relationship? Like, what's the equivalent? And I was like, it's kind of like hiring a new vice president or something. There should be a contract. And so we came up with a relationship contract. It was a 3-month contract to be my official girlfriend, and I would be her official boyfriend. And it had terms that we listed out about like how we would act, what we would do. We would report back to the shareholders. We created these worksheets that we would fill out. And it was all very performative and silly on the one hand. Like, she was very into this as well, and it was very playful. But at the same time, we did have to have like pretty real conversations about like what we wanted, which, you know, you don't tend to have when you first start dating someone. Usually it's fun for a while, then as it gets serious, you have the more serious conversations. But like right away, she was just like, you know, like there were things like how often we would spend the night at each other's house and in what state the house should be in and how often we would have sex and what we, you know, like all of these various aspects of our relationship started to be defined. We went through the 3 months and then, you know, extended, I think it was like 6 months, you know, and things kind of just like kept going from there. Each major decision that we made would be incorporated into these shareholder questions.
And to what extent, because you've said that you found it useful to have the kind of guiding hand of the shareholders, genuinely, beyond it being a kind of artistic experiment. But to what extent did you then find yourself performing for them?
At this point, it didn't feel like forced. It felt like it felt very fun. Like I felt like I had met someone who was equally up for this performance and this game and playing in this way that I was. And, you know, we would do these like photo shoots together with a friend and do very like kind of like stock image style, formal portraits in various like corporate poses and things. And it was very playful and it was very fun. And it didn't feel restrictive at all.
And then you started getting publicity.
Yeah, there's a writer from The Atlantic that reached out. And then soon after that, a writer from Wired. And so there was like these two articles that I knew were sort of going to happen. And they ended up coming out like right at the same time. So there's momentum in the project.
What kind of interest are we talking? I mean, how many shares did you suddenly end up selling?
I mean, share price popped up. Like, I think at that time it was probably around like $5-6, and I think started going, you know, like it was a noticeable increase to like $7-8.
Wow.
And the really insane thing that happened right after that is, I think based on the Atlantic article, someone from the Today Show reached out and said, hey, we read this article. Would you want to come on the Today Show? And I was very much underestimating the power of morning television. Like, I thought like Wired, that's like my target demo. People are going to see that. They're going to get excited. They're going to want to buy a couple shares. It was like a blip compared to what happened after being on TV.
And we're back now at 8:12 with an interesting question. Would you let some total strangers decide who you date and what you wear? In a moment, we're going to meet a guy who sold stock in himself. He now has shareholders. But first, here's NBC's Amna Nawaz.
5 years ago, Mike Merrill started a new company.
Immediately afterwards, just a flood of new shareholders coming in. Share price goes insane. I think it hit like $20. There weren't any more shares to buy for a while. Like the whole thing was just like, I was like, oh, this is real now.
So hold on. At $20 a share?
Yeah.
That's $2 million you're valuing yourself at, right?
Well, they're valuing me at, but yeah.
What did these new people want, though? I imagine it was very different to what your dad and your brother wants when they're following you.
And it was also interesting because it was the first time I really faced kind of the wrath of people. This idea is also pretty anti-human, you know, like it's, and there's a dystopian element to it that I like to play with. It's rubbed a couple people the wrong way, but mostly been fine.
Have you had people say to you, look, this is self-indulgent, this is about your ego, you know, you've let this dominate your, it's just a stupid idea and you've let it dominate your life?
Two responses to that. One, the sort of like playful asshole response I have is like, oh, do you want to short the shares? Because I'll loan you some shares. You can short me and maybe you can profit off my demise. You know, like that's a little bit of like the playfulness of. The other part is like, yeah, it doesn't always work. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I'm putting myself in a weird position. But it is, for the most part, with rare exceptions, this affects me and no one else. And if you don't like it, like, go watch Netflix, go do your own thing. You know, there's an entire internet plus entire world out there to do things with. Like, that's fine. For me individually, I'm like, well, this is an experiment, and an experiment is useful even if it fails. You still learn something from it.
But experiments of this kind, I think this is what's quite interesting about your story, tend to last for a few months or years. And already at this point in the story, you've moved us forward, what, 4, 5, 6 years, something like that. And this is about 9 years ago. So we're talking about a very long-term project here. You're choosing to stay in it.
It's important to me that it's not a stunt. And that's part of why I've avoided putting it in an art context or calling it an art project. It's like you can, if something's in that gallery setting, especially if it's performative, it's very easy to say, oh, that is separate from the real world. And for me, I'm like, I'm more interested in this and how it actually works in real life and how it affects me. It's been going for so long now that it's hard to remember how weird it is. You know, I mean, it's probably not unlike growing up in Alaska. You know, like I'm in an abnormal environment every day.
Are you in a relationship now?
I am. My current partner, Catherine, when we started dating, she looked at sort of the history of this project and decided that she would never buy shares.
Has anyone expressed any interest in turning your story into a film?
Yeah, it's happened a couple times. The first was on the Wired article. My life rights got packaged with that story, and it's a very common thing that happens here in LA that sounds insane. The idea that you can sell your life rights is really strange, but in the way of these things, it ended up fizzling out. Right when I moved to LA, it happened again, and as Hollywood can be, it was very salesy and pushy, and eventually I was like, sure, okay, let's try this, and there was an attempt to do a TV show, and it also didn't go anywhere. And it's funny because like now I'm kind of on this like third try. One of my friends who is also a shareholder and I are working on a book proposal.
This is what's so interesting. You know, when I said earlier that other people do this kind of thing for a little while, and often it is because they are going to write a book about it. And that's the reason. And there's nothing ignoble about that. It's just that's their aim. But I feel like with you, if that book comes out, which I hope it does, you're going to carry on doing this, aren't you?
And where does it end? That's actually, it's an interesting aspect that we talked about with the editor is like, he was saying, you know, there's things like those books like A Year of Living Biblically or The Guy That Didn't Throw Any of His Trash Away for a Year or something like that. And if I'd been smarter at the beginning, I could have done this for a year, shut it down, sold a book, moved on. But in my mind, for some reason, it's really important that it's not a stunt, you know, just going back to that. And so I don't actually know where this ends. You know, like this project, I mean, I think it very likely ends when I die, you know, but maybe not. Maybe the shareholder community can keep going after that. I want if it does end, I've always said that I want it to end in that same kind of capitalist spirit. So, you know, how do companies end? They either, it's a merger or bankruptcy, or I mean, hopefully it's not a scandal, but I mean that would also potentially be an exit. Maybe a leveraged buyout or take the company private. You know, there needs to be a sort of a corporate equivalent to however it ends.
How do you think it's going to end?
I think because I am an American and I have this sense that we all do that we're all going to be rich and successful. I think it's going to be like I'm going to buy it back. I'm going to get super rich and famous and I'm going to have the money to basically buy out all my shareholders and take myself private.
Interesting. I mean, what is the current share price on the day of recording, by the way?
$7.20. I don't know. In my mind, I don't think I could convince anyone to buy a share. I think all I can do is yell to as many people as possible that I'm doing this weird thing and let the other weirdos come to me. You know, I've talked about this project as like a lighthouse for like-minded weirdos. Like, they're attracted to it for reasons that are their own and probably talk to their own strange upbringings, you know, and loneliness and whatever it is. And for me, you know, it's sense of like, I want to have a community. I think for me, a big part of it is I'm creating the virtual version of the community I never had, you know, growing up. And if other people, I think they can feel a sense of that. There's not a sense that this thing is anything other than an extension of a network of friends of mine. Like, that's the feeling that I have when I think about the shareholders.
Mike Merrill. And if you would like to join Mike's network of friends, then you can buy a share at kmikeym.com. That's kmikeym.com. I'll put a link up on our website. My thanks to producer Annalise Freimark for her assistance editing that feature. Remember, if you have a story that you'd like to share on the show, then do reach out. We are at modernmanwith2ns.co.uk. Still to come, help for a man who's still to come. That's Alex Fox after this. Right, time now to revisit a classic edition of The Foxhole, because at the time we needed to record this month's show, Alex Fox was just about to head off on her Easter holiday and then got ill and wasn't feeling herself. And she was coughing and spluttering and generally not sounding like someone you would want to hear talking about sex. We tried a couple of times to record with her, but it just wasn't happening. So, Alex, get well soon. Enjoy your holiday. And Alex will be back as usual next month. Send in your questions now. But we thought instead we'd rerun a Foxhole section from the very first series of The Modern Man from back in 2015. I actually sound younger in this item, I think you'll agree. Back in those days, the show was weekly, but the production was even more scrappy than it is now and recorded in some unusual locations. It is time for our weekly trip down the Foxhole, which is being recorded for one time only in a car. So I'm tempted to call this section, Alex, the car of love.
I'm tempted to call the police because it feels like you're kidnapping me.
We did just text Alex when she said, where are we meeting up this week? And said that it was in a Ford Mondeo parked off St Martin's Lane, to which she responded, is there going to be any dogging?
Yeah, I sort of feel like
it's 6 o'clock in the evening in the West End. Does dogging ever happen in those circumstances?
Maybe not, but have you seen those porn films where they just they put someone in the back of a van? Like the Bang, I think it's called Bang Brothers.
I'm not ashamed to say I have, yes. This does feel like the setup to neither me nor producer Matt are quite the right type, though, to then take command of the car. But there is an empty seat at the moment which the driver could fill.
No banging is going to go on in this vehicle.
Just banging talk.
Just the banging of the door when I get out in a second.
Let's move on to this week's question of sex.
Ooh.
It is from Patrick, who says, I'm an 18-year-old student who recently found a girlfriend who lives in the flat above me in Halls.
Nice move, Patrick. That's highly convenient.
As a consequence, pretty much every night for the last 3 weeks, we've been having sex multiple times a night.
Oh, Patrick, go you.
The only problem is that by the second or third time each night, I find myself unable to reach orgasm properly, and so have, for the last week or so, resorted to faking my own finish out of sheer exhaustion and frustration. And that's interesting, isn't it? You don't ever really hear about men faking orgasms.
That's actually more common than you'd imagine. There was a study done by the University of Kansas that showed that 25% of men have faked it at some point in their lives.
Really?
Yeah.
I really do enjoy having sex with this girl, he says, and I don't mind the frankly obscene amounts of it we're having. And I don't mind not reaching orgasm every time, but is there a way that would help me finish in a more traditional manner? He's managed to phrase this like a Victorian gentleman.
Yeah, it sounds like a shepherd's pie or something.
Or is it, Alex, that I've simply overworked my bits to the extent where there isn't enough semen to finish the job? She hasn't noticed yet due to condom use, but she says she's switching to the pill soon, so I might be caught out.
Just a heads up, Patrick. If your girlfriend is switching to the pill, remember that that prevents pregnancy, but it doesn't protect either of you from diseases. So please nip down your clinic and just check that you're both A-OK in that region before you proceed.
I don't want to tell her that we're having too much sex, because I think she'll think it's her fault, and I don't want to hurt her feelings.
That is a very common reason for men faking orgasms, that they don't want their lady friend to think that they're not sufficiently turned on by her beauteous, bounteous body, and that's the reason that they're not coming.
Which is the same reason that women traditionally fake orgasms, isn't it?
Or, yeah,
or they just want it to be over with.
Or it can be because you're tired or you're stressed. Antidepressants can make it really hard for guys to come as well.
Oh, really?
They can make it take a really long time before they ejaculate.
So what should he do?
Well, for a start, I don't think he's got anything to worry about at all. The time it takes for a gent to recharge his barrel, so to speak, if he's ejaculated once, before he can go again, is called the refractory period. His refractory period sounds like it might be slightly longer than another gent his age, but it's absolutely nothing to worry about at all. If you are jizzing freely at least twice, if not three times a night, then you have diddly squat to worry about. You're A-OK.
But he wants to come, doesn't he, the third time by the sound of it? The hidden question here might be, is there a technique I can employ to ensure that actually I do ejaculate genuinely the third time? And I suppose the answer to that is just wait a little bit longer between sessions.
Just wait a little bit longer. You might find that if you're really going for it, and if these sessions are happening one after the other, Patrick might be really dehydrated, so you might need to just drink some water, put some liquid back into his system, but that's not going to cause an immediate effect. There's very little that you can do to conjure up cum from nowhere, but there's plenty you can do to make sure his sex life is still satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
For a start, he might want to look into dry orgasms, which can be achieved via practicing tantra. This involves training your body to the point where you can feel the sensations of orgasm without actually any liquid being shot out of your willy. I think at some point as well he should speak to his girlfriend and make it clear to her that perhaps her expectations are unrealistic,
yes,
even for a chap of his age. She might be relieved to have that
absolutely
chat as well.
To be honest,
she might be chafed.
Absolutely,
to high heaven.
I was thinking that too. And actually, you know, how do you know, Patrick, that she's not faking with you that third time?
She's
really
probably more grated than a bag of cheddar down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is they're having sex so often that there's no diplomatic time to have a conversation about the fact that he's faking and she's sore, because it sounds like they're almost constantly bonking.
He can make it diplomatic, or either of them can, by suggesting that they switch things up a little bit. Penetrative sex isn't the only form of sex. He might suggest to her that he gives an erotic massage, or there's an app that's about to be launched. I think it launches officially on Valentine's Day 2016, but they're asking for testers for it at the moment, so where Patrick and his missus could get their hands on it early and give it a little whirl. It's called Pillow. And it's like a virtual sex trainer. You download it to your phone, you select a 15-minute lesson, and then you play that workshop out loud whilst you and your partner are in the room. And it gives you instructions on what to do to each other.
Right.
So it's like a virtual coach.
Like TomTom, but for where to put your fingers.
And other parts of yourself.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. GPS for your V and your P. Yeah.
I wonder who does the voiceover on that.
They did have it. It started off with one particular girl, but now I think you can choose the voice as well.
You can have comedy ones like on TomTom. You can have Homer Simpson. I think really, though, Patrick, by the time you hear this episode, it's
your
probably
dick will
sorted
have
itself
fallen
out
off from overuse.
Well, let's be honest. That three times a night ratio. You know, I know he's only 18. I know they're students. Still, probably after a week, that's gone down to twice a night, has it not?
It didn't for me. I was ragingly at it during my teens.
Really?
I had one very long-term relationship after another. And in the first one, we both lived in the country and obviously both lived with our parents. There was nowhere for us to go to have a little fertile. So the minute that this particular chap passed his driving test, the car became quite literally the vehicle for sex. So
it's appropriate that we're in a car.
It's appropriate that we're sat in one. But yeah, sort of.
It's another app that saved the day. Zip cars probably come along and helped all kinds of teenagers get off.
I do sort of miss escaping from the family home in a Peugeot 306 and going wild down a country lane. Yeah.
And so ends our weekly trip down the foxhole. Alex, if people have a question of sex for you for a future episode of the show, where do they need to go to fill your box?
If they head on over to modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and they click on the feedback form, then they can ask me a question, they can keep themselves anonymous, or they can reveal their name or indeed any other details they care to share.
So there you have it, a trip down memory lane that was. Alex will be back with an all-new Foxhole next month. By the way, I checked out Pillow on the App Store, and these days it's a sleep tracker for Apple Watch, so I suspect a totally different product to the one that Alex was talking about there. I did enjoy the retro references to TomTom in that segment, though. Also, Patrick, if you're still listening, why not give us an update on the intermittent 8 years? How have they been for your sex life? Are you still with that partner? I imagine now, as a 26-year-old man, this issue of getting through three times per night feels slightly less relevant to you. But do drop us a line. Click on the feedback form at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. That is the same website for you guys to head to, of course, if you would like to be a Mambassador. Now is a great time to reach out and get on the list, and it could be your name I'm mentioning this time next month in this section. And of course, you can buy us a beer on our website as well and help support the show. In the meantime, our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. And we'll see you with something new on May the 10th.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.